This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I mean, as you know, as David said, you know, the book is an attempt to try to break away from a certain contemporary tradition of thought, represented recently by people like Jan Assmann in his book on Moses the Egyptian, who have tried to see sort of the real source of intolerance in the West as being grounded in monotheism, which Assmann calls the counter-religion. And what he means by a counter-religion is a religion that is, first of all, not grounded in nature, in revelation. Well, it's not grounded in revelation. It's grounded in natural phenomena. He calls these religions cosmotheisms rather than pagan. And he argues that with Judaism, you really first have a religion that makes the distinction between true religion and false religion. False religion is everything that's now, you know, considered to be pagan. So it's really only with Judaism that you have statements like Israel in truth and Egypt in error. And he wants to argue, he's an Egyptologist, and he ultimately says Freud was right, probably right, that, you know, the originary monotheism was Egyptian, Akhenaten, and, you know, whether there was this, you know, Moses character who brought it, you know, from the court of Akhenaten and brought it to the Israelites, that's not the point. The point is that, I mean, it's a weird argument. What he wants to do is in a way, free the Jews from the curse of monotheism. In a way, he says monotheism is as bad as we've been saying, but the Egyptians invented it. So it's a strange argument, and it basically enlists Freud and his book Moses and Monotheism in what is in some sense ultimately an anti-Mosaic argument, not to say anti-Semitic, but an anti-Mosaic, still claiming that the fundamental trauma, that all intolerance, all deep religiously felt enmity in the West is ultimately grounded in this new kind of religious formation, a religion that claims truth because based on revelation, on voice, on language, rather than natural phenomena. Because ultimately, the names of gods, he says, could be translated if they're grounded in cosmic or natural phenomena. You call it this, we call it that. You could translate, but you can't translate the monotheistic God. You can't translate Yahweh. You just Jupiter is not Yahweh. Jupiter is false. So what intrigued me about Assmann's project and other people, Regina Schwartz, The Curse of Cain, also argues that the biblical traditions are really the source of, you know, of the worst sorts of intolerance. It's not that there's not other kinds of intolerance, you know, in pagan civilizations, but that there's a new kind of intolerance that has a kind of extremity, a kind of radicalism that's new, that's distinctive. And she too also wants to link it to biblical traditions, ultimately to Judaism. Now, what both of them do, and this is what really got me going, was that they both enlist Freud in their project. They both ultimately try to use Freud's Moses and monotheism and theory of trauma to make their point. And what I wanted to do in this project is to suggest that actually in monotheism we get a very radical understanding of what is strange about the other, which is, you know, at least what I'll try to argue, is not the other's mores, the other's values, the other's customs, but some fundamental sort of torsion or twist or almost perversion in the other's way of being in the world, which is transmitted in their, let's say, ethnic particularity or traditions, but isn't defined by them. It's something that belongs to them, but as something excessive and unintelligible to them. Another way of putting it, I mean, there's this famous quote in Hegel, the enigmas of the Egyptians were enigmas for the Egyptians. You know, that the way I like to put it, that even the Egyptians suffered a certain kind of Egyptomania. That is a kind of hypercathexis of enigmas. And that's why I actually chose for the cover of the book this Paul Klee image, which is Legend from the Nile. And they are really, sort of like these hieroglyphs. And in a certain sense, what the argument of the book is that sort of makes the other is, in a certain sense, their particular form of Egyptomania. And that the exodus that is elaborated in Judaic tradition, that the exodus that at stake there is not simply the exodus from Egypt, that is from, let's say, official forms of enslavement and slavery, but from one's Egyptomania. That is the sort of the unconscious modes of choosing one's servitude. The way that the unconscious operates in one's attachment, one's binding to an ideological formation. And so, let's say a Sabbath or an Exodus, that is these different metaphors for suspension of enslavement to the rhythms of the world. Also, I'm arguing has to be thought in this psychoanalytic way as an intervention into the bindingness or the phantasmatic dimensions of one's attachments to normativity, to a reigning normativity. So that, fundamentally is the argument of the book. And it only really became possible for me to really open this up once I started. I couldn't just do it with Freud somehow, and Freud didn't seem enough. And I started reading Franz Rosenzweig's work. Franz Rosenzweig is probably best known for co-translating the Bible with Martin Buber into German. And oddly enough, he did this in the late 1920s while he was almost completely paralyzed with Lou Gehrig's disease. He had a system of communication with his wife. She would go through the alphabet and through eye blinks. He would, stop at letters. I mean, before that, he had someone constructed a special typewriter that he could just use with one finger. But eventually, he couldn't use his hands. He couldn't speak. And just through eye blinks, he co-translated the Bible with Martin Buber, or at least a good part of it. And he's also well known for co-founding the Das Jüdische Lehrhaus, which is basically starting the movement for adult Jewish education in Frankfurt, which then became the model for such schools and projects throughout Germany. And there's even online, there's something called Das Jüdische Lehrhaus, an American group that's trying to continue the Rosenzweigian project, on the internet. But let me begin. So ultimately, I'm going to try to bring to the project is to bring together Freud and Rosenzweig. Rosenzweig knew Freud's work a bit. He cites a little bit of Freud in his memoirs. As far as I know, in his diaries. As far as I know, there are no references in any of Freud's work to Rosenzweig. Although he was extremely well known among German Jews and also Austrian Jews, but mostly more German Jews. And every German Jewish intellectual in the 20s knew of Rosenzweig, and many sort of made a pilgrimage to him after he became paralyzed. Benjamin went to visit him, and as many of you know, Benjamin's book on Baroque tragedy was deeply indebted, at least to the first volume of The Star of Redemption, which I'll talk about a bit. But let me begin in the first third of this paper. by talking about Freud. Freud's crucial breakthrough, the feature that distinguishes his conception of the unconscious from all previous attempts to think this other scene, is that unconscious mental activity has something mechanical or something machine-like about it. This is why interpretation, which remains strictly within the register of sense, of the practical unity of life as a space of reason, is helpless before the insistence of unconscious formations, which are ultimately insensitive to the question, why are you doing that? Psychoanalysis, now of course, in symptomatic behavior, someone could always come up with a reason. You know, well, my hands are dirty. You know, I shook, you know, I did his, you don't know where his hand was. I have to shake my hand, wash my hands again. There's always a reason, but in psychoanalysis, the reason is a, you know, is, it comes after the restlessness of the activity. So psychoanalysis is in some sense born with the perplexity apropos of symptomatic behavior, with the reflexive breakdowns that it generates. Thus, from the project on, Freud emphasized the persistence within the dynamics of symptom formation of a non-semantic kernel that can only be approached by a discourse and practice attuned to quantitative energetics, to the psychophysical dimension of symbolization below the level of intentionality. And so it's very clear in the project, it becomes less clear in the later work why you need energy and meaning. Energy looks like a leftover from a biological model of the mind, but my argument is that it's actually, in a way, the most advanced part of Freud's thinking, that you have to have this paradoxical intersection of sense and energy, or else you can't get at what the subject of the psychoanalysis is doing in symptomatic behavior. In Lacanian terms, unconscious mental activity, or we could just call it symptomatic agency, there's an agency there, but it's symptomatic agency. You can't call it strictly, it's not simply intentional. It's not like there are intentions that are hidden from you that this other mind is engaging in. It's that this other agency is another form of agency that can't be captured by thinking about our understanding of intentional activity, intentional behaviors. So in Lacanian terms, symptomatic agency is organized precisely around signifiers. This is how I understand what he means by signifiers. That is, they're not full-fledged meanings, purposes, or propositional attitudes, yet they belong to the space of meaning. It's not fully meaning, but it's no longer simply the energy of the body. There is, in the Freudian view, something about mindedness, about having a human mind, that is itself mindless, non-teleological, that cannot be captured by our normal understanding of what meaningful, purposeful behavior looks like. The persistence of a mindlessness imminent to mindedness, a persistence that typically causes us a certain amount of pain, is, I think, ultimately what Lacan means by the term jouissance. There's always more to our neighbor than his conscious beliefs, attitudes, commitments, but this more is not a second hidden set of other, somehow more true beliefs, attitudes, and commitments that even our neighbor is blocked from acknowledging, but rather the persistence of what I'd like to call significant stress. That is, there's a kind of stress in the other, and the stress is it's not like the beating of a heart. It's not like breathing. It's not simply bodily. It's connected to significance, but it's not simply meaningful either. So we have, you know, so you find in throughout Freud these hybrid formulations that sometimes look like biological formulations, sometimes look like hermeneutic, or, you know, in the world of meaning. By this term, I aim at avoiding the misunderstanding that the mechanical, nonsensical nature of symptomatic agency represents some sort of physiological mechanism analogous to the beating of the heart, which can also, of course, be considered mindless or nonsensical. I mean, the beating of the heart is nonsensical, but it's not nonsensical the way symptomatic agency is. Framed by such a misunderstanding, Freud's famous dictum, wo es war, soll ich werden, would then mean that the task of analysis is the molding or domestication of primitive quasi-biological energies of the drives into rational capacities and behaviors, the transmutation of the natural pulsational core of life into flexible or emotional orientations in a shared world. Analysis would, in other words, be a form of Bildung, a form of cultivating the or disciplining the body and forcing it to confess its, you know, the leftovers of its pre-symbolic existence, and drawing them into the mesh of the symbolic. But I want to say that Freud's conception of the mechanistic aspect of the mind, as manifest, for example, in repetition compulsion, clearly pertains to the dimension of meaning itself, and not to some more primitive biological substratum of meaning. The subject of psychoanalysis, what I've referred to as symptomatic agency, begins not with biological life, but rather where biological life is amplified and perturbed by the symbolic dimension of relationality, at the very heart of which lie problems of authority and authorization. I know that's a very dense sentence, so let me just say it again, because I mean it's sort of the core of what I'm proposing. So the symptomatic agency, or the subject of psychoanalysis, begins not with biological life, but rather where biological life is amplified and perturbed by the symbolic dimension of relationality, at the very heart of which lie problems of authority and authorization. So, to put it this way, it's you don't get the subject of psychoanalysis without intentional relations, but the subject of psychoanalysis can't be captured by intentionality. It comes with intentionality, with entering the space of intentionality of other subjects intending things, having purposes, but it itself, there's an agency generated thereby that can't be captured in those terms. So again, it's not a leftover of something that hasn't been caught up. So the pre-symbolic is in a certain sense generated by the symbolic. The leftover in a certain sense comes after. To borrow a term from Giorgio Agamben, we might say that the life that is of concern to psychoanalysis is biopolitical life, life that has been thrown by the enigma of its legitimacy, the question of its place and authorization within a meaningful order. Our question then is, how are we to understand this peculiar form of animation, the quasi-mechanical insistence that distinguishes biopolitical life, that comes to a human life by way of its habitation of the dimension where, as Agamben puts it, sovereignty borders on the sphere of life and becomes indistinguishable from it. I mean, for those of you who know Agamben, you know, who know a bit of Agamben's work, he's very interested, you know, in sovereignty and the state of exception, you know, the legacy of Carl Schmitt. In a certain sense, what I want to say is that that the subject of psychoanalysis is, in a certain sense, born with exposure to a state of exception that's communicated in all symbolic mandates issued to us in the course of life. In intersubjective life, we're confronted at some fundamental level with questions of our authorization, of the resources that make us feel legitimate, authorized to be in the social space. And that the enigma of that authorization, the various ways we become addicted to the enigma of our legitimation, our authorization, the resources, where these resources come from, are they mine? When do they become mine? You know, when does a symbolic investiture really take hold and I say, that's me? That this is what, you know, symptomatic agency is running through, trying to discharge. Now, one way of thinking about this is to think about some of the key words of that Freud uses, and actually some of these actually work better in English than in the German. And think of the most important word is excitation. In German, it's Erregung. It doesn't quite work, but I mean, it works with another German, with Ladung, which Freud also uses, which Ladung can mean charging, like a battery, wird geladen. There's an elektrische Ladung, but Ladung also means a summons to appear before a court. And the same with excitation. I mean, excitation is clearly an energy, it's connected with energy, a quantum of energy, but it's also comes from excitare, which is, you know, being summoned out, being called out. And I think this is where, I think for me, in Freud, sort of the energetics and meaning come together in sort of the being addressed and called out. Excuse me?
How about induction?
Excuse me?
How about induction?
Induction too, right. I mean, induction is also being led, and right, yeah. So, I mean, Freud is clearly always drawn to these hybrid terms, and it's because for him the subject of psychoanalysis is generated by this, is a mode of this hybridity. In Moses and monotheism, this semantic hybridity comes to the fore where Freud invokes the theory of trauma to make sense of the uncanny compulsiveness he discerned at the heart of what we might call Jewish spiritual functioning. Clearly, Freud thought that, you know, that, I mean, he did, you know, in a certain sense, subscribe to what could be called anti-Semitic tropes of the 19th century, you know, of, in a certain sense, of the wandering Jew, of the restless, you know, kind of fundamental Jewish restlessness. But Freud was interested in this, you know, he basically, you know, religions take hold of people only when there's a compulsive dimension involved. I was actually just, well, that's, let me read this and then I'll do my tangents. In Moses and monotheism, okay, he invokes the theory of trauma. In the course of his presentation, he uses an expression devised to capture the purely quantitative aspect of trauma, its status as a too much of pressure that exceeds the working of the pleasure principle, the patterns of diffusion and discharge that constitute human mindedness in its normal functioning. So he's proposing a purely quantitative understanding of trauma as too much, a flooding of the mind. And this is what he says. Every trauma must, Freud says, contain something on the order of, and the phrase he uses is, ein zu viel von Anspruch, an excess of demand. And clearly Anspruch does mean sort of like a demand on a system for work. But the word comes from ansprechen, you know, it means address. Ich spreche sie an. You know, ein Anspruch is a claim, sort of a vocal claim, or a symbolic claim. So we might say that at least under certain circumstances, a trauma is generated by too much of address, by an excess imminent to an address that resists symbolization that is symbolically indigestible. To bring the two meanings of Anspruch together, we can put it this way. A trauma becomes possible when a too much of address persists beyond what can be translated into a demand for work, a task to be discharged, something we can do. In a certain sense, you could say that normally we function normally when, let's say, these unconscious Ansprüche that we're bombarded with in the course of our life, especially, you know, in early childhood, when we can convert, when we can translate them into a purpose in life. You know, I'm going to be a doctor, or, I mean, some way of organizing one's life, you know, well, in response to what? To a vocation, you know, a voice, some sort of calling. Now, what Freud is saying that, you know, that neurotic symptoms are really generated when there's an excess, when no matter what you do, it's not it. So nothing you can do could discharge the pressure of the call. So in a certain sense, you develop alternative vocations, as it were. You know, neurotic symptoms are you know, professions. You know, they're sort of vocations, but unconscious vocations. More precisely, trauma ensues when such a remainder precipitates a breakdown of this very operation of translation, leaving the mind flooded by excitation. Let me quote from Jonathan Lear in one of his essays. I think it's the essay on the Rat Man. Tries to capture, you know, this quantitative dimension in Freud. This is what he says: for Freud, the fundamental mental molecule was an idea plus quota of energy, which he called affect. It was the transfer of this energy along the varying paths of ideas that allowed Freud to explain the formation of neurotic symptoms in dreams. In this use, psychic energy seems to be the matter of a form and matter unity. But then, how could there be a case of pure formless matter? How can there be mental energy without an idea? I think the answer is to take this as a limit case of the mental, somewhat analogous to treating zero as a number. The reason for doing this is to capture the phenomenon of trauma and of momentary breakthroughs. These are vicissitudes of the mental. So the idea that you need this notion of mental energy without an idea, not simply bodily energy, but mental energy, but mental energy without an idea, without a representation. And that's, in a way, what's most distinctive about unconscious activity, that there is such a thing. That, and again, it's a hybrid mental energy. What could that be? In a certain sense, all of psychoanalysis is an attempt to think, you know, mental energy, you know, this peculiar hybrid stuff. What Lear is getting at here, I think, can also be clarified by reference to a crucial distinction that Jean Laplanche, the French psychoanalyst Jean Laplanche, makes. At the heart of Laplanche's work is the difference between what he calls a signifier of something and a signifier to someone. What comes to the fore at certain moments, Laplanche writes, is that aspect of the signifier which signifies to someone, which interpolates someone, in the sense that we can speak of an official signifying a court decision or issuing a decree. This foregrounding of signifying to is extremely important, as a signifier can signify to without its addressee necessarily knowing what it signifies. We know that it signifies, but not what it signifies. Lacan suggests the image of hieroglyphs in the desert, which is another reason why I was drawn to this. It means that the signifier may be designified or lose what it signifies without thereby losing its power to signify to. In a certain sense, another way maybe of thinking this, we are, you know, that he's interested in messages that don't, that in a way don't belong to a form of life. They're coming from a form of life, but they don't fully have a, they don't have a, they're not clearly part of a language game or part of a form of life. So there's something orphaned about these messages. Another way of thinking about it is like objects or artifacts that are left over from a form of life about which we don't know very much. So they clearly signify. I mean, we put them in museums, we collect them, and we try to reinsert them into a form of life. But clearly there's something, part of the, you know, you could even say the fetishism of these objects is that there's, that we can't fully reinsert them into the form of life in which they would really have their meaning. So they're signifying, but they're not signifying something to us. They're signifying to us. Another way of thinking about it is, you know, like what Nietzsche means by the death of God. I mean, if you have the word God, the concept God, but you don't pray, in other words, you don't engage in the form of life in which God, you know, really has its meaning, you don't really know, you don't really fully have the concept God, yet you're still, it clearly has a, let's say, it's still signifying to you, but without the form of life in which God is, you know, which the concept God really functions, it's not, there's a disproportion between what it signifies and its signifying to. And I bring up the example of God because another passage I'd like to read comes from Gershom Scholem in his correspondence with Walter Benjamin about Kafka. And there, you know, they're writing back and forth. In part, it's a response to Benjamin's essay on Kafka. And in the course of the correspondence, Scholem uses the phrase, you know, that Kafka's world is a world determined by the nothingness of revelation. And Benjamin asks him what he means and, you know, argues with him about it. And this is what Scholem responds, this is how he responds. You ask what I understand by the nothingness of revelation. I understand by it a state in which revelation appears to be without meaning, in which it still asserts itself, in which it has validity but no significance. And the German is, indem sie gilt, aber nicht bedeutet. A state in which the wealth of meaning is lost, and what is in the process of appearing, for revelation is such a process, still does not disappear, even though it is reduced to the zero point of its own content, so to speak. Now, it's precisely this nothingness of revelation, this excess of validity over significance, that so profoundly captures the imagination of the protagonists of Kafka's novels, that becomes, as it were, the most important thing in their lives, the thing from which they are forever struggling to establish a proper distance. The encounter with this nothingness of revelation, this excess of validity over significance, is, I want to say, neither simply enlivening nor simply deadening, but rather, at least the way I want to put it is, it's undeadening. I think we need this other term, undeadening, and maybe it's good, you know, it's Halloween, that we're talking about the undead. That is, it produces in us an internal alienness that has a peculiar sort of vitality and yet belongs to no form of life. So what I want to say is that Kafka's work is in a certain sense so important because it captures so powerfully this paradox of validity beyond significance, Bedeutung ohne Geltung. So what this claim, what Scholem's claim, if he's right, what Kafka's work the way we could think of Kafka's work is as an allegory of the psychoanalytic claim that my induction into the socio-symbolic order is not about my learning a language. I mean, I think for a long time, I think, you know, at least people working on Lacan were fixated, you know, on the Saussure connection, that what Lacan was trying to talk about was what it is to be, you know, the trauma of being drawn into a symbolic order in the sense of a language, of learning a language. But I want to say that the key to this Lacanian notion of, you know, of the signifier is not Saussure, but Kafka. That what he means by the signifier is precisely what Kafka is trying to get at, this excess of address over meaning. That's what the signifier. That's the signifier that gets under the skin and becomes the source object of the drives. And, you know, another way of thinking about it is to think about, if you think about it, so Althusser's famous discussion of interpolation, you know, the famous scene, the cop on the street hails you and you turn around and you've been interpolated into a subject of ideology, because when you turn around, you recognize yourself as the one who's been called, who's rightfully been called. In a certain sense, you identify with the order in the name of which you've been addressed. Now, what Saussure doesn't get in that model is, you could say, the dimension of the voice. That is, it gets the meaning, it gets at the order of, let's say, it remains within interpolation but doesn't get to a beyond of interpolation, which is still part of the mechanism of interpolation, which is the voice getting under the skin, in a way, the vocal object. And if you think at the end of Kafka's The Trial, there is just such a scene in the cathedral when Joseph K. goes to, you know, to give his tour to the Italian business associate. He doesn't show up and he's wandering around the cathedral. He sees the chaplain and he's starting to walk out and he hears Joseph K. And there's this moment where Joseph K. is going through the permutations. If I turn, then, you know, what? And if I don't turn, and just, but in a way, what it looks just like the scene of, you know, of ideological interpolation in Althusser. But what the whole novel has been about is about this obscene excess that can't be fully, that isn't simply about meaning or about identification. It's about some traumatic dimension that exceeds identification, that nonetheless supports identification. Anyway, that's what makes Kafka, you know, so incredible, is that the whole oeuvre, in a way, is an elaboration of this, becomes at some level an elaboration of this dynamic. So what I want to say is, so what is at stake for, what I ultimately want to argue is that what is at stake for Freud and for Rosenzweig, about whom I haven't spoken really, is precisely the problem of an exodus out of, you know, what I want to call this Egyptomania, this the way in which this traumatic excess of validity over signification of the vocal object over the meaning, the way we, you know, our modes of being addicted to that enigmatic dimension, that in a way both Rosenzweig and Freud are interested in intervening there, not at the level of our identities, our symbolic, you know, our symbolic roles. It's not about choosing other identities, but at the mode, the way in which we're bound to our identities. And another way of thinking about this is, you know, since I introduced this term undeadness, so what is at stake in psychoanalysis, if you want to sort of introduce, you know, the messianic dimension, which was so important for Rosenzweig and also Benjamin, much less so for Freud, You have to think of it not as in the normal way that when the Messiah comes, there'll be a reanimation of the dead, but really what it's about is a deanimation of the undeadness. That it's this suspension of that excess labor, that not the normal labor in the community, as it were, but this excess labor that in a way binds us to our social world in such a manner that we can't acknowledge possibilities for new possibility. We can't see new possibilities of community, of engagement, of political action. There's a kind, that's where our blindness is, you know, in that dimension of the social contract. That's where the social contract is most profoundly sealed. And that's what both Freud and Rosenzweig, that's where they're trying to intervene. What's interesting for Rosenzweig is very interested in I think what I would call singularity rather than identity. And by singularity, what I want to say is that you only get, you know, you only acquire singularity by virtue of this strange process of interpolation that includes a beyond of interpolation. That is, it's what makes you singular is not the series of attributes, you know, of predicates that you have. You know, think of personal ads, you know, the list of predicates that make you who you are. Clearly that's that all belongs, let's say, to the space of identity. Your singularity is something that it's sort of like the in a certain sense, your symptomatic agency, your utterly idiomatic or idiosyncratic symptomatic agency. In a certain sense, your particular way of suffering your identities. And again, it's not that that's a good thing. Singularity is, it's, you know, we think that it's, you know, great, I'm not like anyone else. Well, it's also, you know, it's also the place of your anxiety. So it's good and bad. I mean, for Rosenzweig, it's good in that it singles you out and makes you available for Rosenzweig, it's what makes you available for a divine address. Or at least, you know, to put it in less extreme terms, it makes you available to neighbor love, to what he understands as love of neighbor. And maybe this is tautologist, but I think for Rosenzweig, love of neighbor is not unlike psychoanalytic listening. It's listening to, in a way, for the pulsation of the symptomatic agency, which is, I want to say, your singularity. And it's not with the intention of celebrating it, celebrating the singularity. You could say particularity, you could celebrate, ethnic particularity. That's fine, that's what you celebrate. But your singularity is not what you celebrate. Your singularity is also a kind of cringe. The particular way you're cringed in your movement through the world, you know, a certain torsion of your being. It makes you singular, but it also, you know, it's a kind of enslavement. It's a site of enslavement. But for Rosenzweig, that's what neighbor love is addressing. And that's precisely what I mean. It's a strangeness that's not given by virtue of your symbolic identifications. In a certain sense, it's not who you are in any recognizable sense. In a way, you don't need neighbor love for that. You could have simply just rituals of acknowledgement, tribal hospitality. What I think Rosenzweig sees in the Judeo-Christian tradition is a different mode of attention to the neighbor. And you could maybe to put it otherwise, this mode of attention in a way, or let's say the neighbor as this singular other only becomes thinkable with this other kind of attention. So in a certain sense, there's a positing of presuppositions. You know, the neighbor in this, you know, radical, you know, alterity only becomes available within the Judeo-Christian tradition. At least that's one argument. Yeah.
You're using neighbor for the second time, and I think that's the first time. Do you mean not God or neighbor?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, in a certain sense, neither. I mean, the word that Rosenzweig uses is der Nächste, yeah, the proximate one. And Yeah, le prochain.
So in a way, it's, again, you're following the order of, the linguistic order in which those two things are not talking about. So this is also a linguistic mechanism, sort of operation.
I'm not sure. I guess what I want to say, what Rosenzweig is interested in by using the term, it's actually interesting. He sometimes uses the term der Nächste, and he sometimes uses the phrase das Nächste, the neuter, which is the next thing rather than the next one. One of the reasons he's very interested in the idea of proximity is his project is also an attempt to, one dimension of his project is a critique of fanaticism. Religious fanaticism. And he sees fanaticism as a leaping beyond the next one, what is most proximate, and going to what is farthest. And in a way, bypassing what is proximate. So he wants the sense of proximity. When he uses das Nächste, I think what he's more interested in is urgency. The next thing, the thing that's demanding our attention now. Yeah, it's definitely, it has to, it's also interesting, Rosenzweig is very adamant that, in fact, you could say he says a lot of very negative things about Islam in The Star of Redemption. And a lot of people are now working on this, especially in light of, current events, just how hostile, really, Rosenzweig is to Islam. He's also hostile to Buddhism, Hinduism, and Taoism, but he's most hostile to Islam. And one of the things he says about Islam is that in Islam, God loves mankind all at once. And in Judaism, it's actually crucial that God doesn't love mankind all at once, but goes by way of election and then sends the nation out among the nations. And then it's crucial that in Christianity, this is converted into each subject. So it becomes universalizable. But the crucial thing is that love, revelatory love, or neighbor love, has to be situated, absolutely situated to the next one, that it can't be immediately, it can't be general. So it can't be a love of mankind. It has to be sort of elected now. Now, and you could say every time you're called upon to act in the urgency of a moment, you could say that's the moment when you're elected. When you're chosen, when you've received the mandate of neighbor love. I mean, I think that's also what Rosenzweig is trying to propose. I don't know that it's that important to give the details of Rosenzweig's arguments, or the technical details of Rosenzweig's mode of presentation of this, of singularity. I could just, abbreviate it the way, or just give you his abbreviations for it. He says that there, it's important to distinguish between the personality and the self. The personality, he has a mathematical formula. He has B equals A. Which in German, he means B stands for das Besondere, the individual, the particular, and A stands for das Allgemeine, the general. So all of our predicates, all the predications we can make about ourselves as parts of the world, come in the form of B equals A. I am an American, I am male, I am this and that. So basically everything that's recognizable about me. But he says that, and he says the personality is the political animal, the member of the social group. Think also about Althusser and interpolation. B equals A is the successful interpolation. I turn around. I am B, my particularity is absorbed into A. I recognize myself in the call. But what Rosenzweig is interested in is also a dimension of contraction from the call. And he even, it thinks of it as, he thinks of it in this quasi-physical sense, this hybrid, physical, meaningful sense of contracting from the call, contracting from the demand. But he wants to suggest that the way you contract from the demand is, in a certain sense, by hardening your character, a kind of, he uses the phrase trotz, defiance. In other words, you become defiantly you. Another way of thinking about it is think of like a Molière's miser. In a sense, you have the ethos of moderation. You could say that's, you know, that's basically what, you know, what an ethos is. You know, in ancient Greece, moderation, living the moderate life. But in a way, when that life of the ethos of moderation is posited defiantly, you get excess. So you have the paradox of moderation becoming excessive, becoming a kind of perverse, defiant moderation, life of moderation. So you, and this is what Rosenzweig calls B equals B. Das Besondere gleicht dem Besonderen. And he calls it the meta-ethical self. It's an ethos, just like the miser, the ethos of moderation, but it's defiantly posited. I am me. So no matter what changes in my life, I am still me. I am still this point of self-referential, spiritual, you know, selfhood. Now, what I want to suggest is that this is what Freud means by, or this what psychoanalysis means by symptomatic agency, that the meta-ethical self is what psychoanalysis posits as sort of the kernel at which analytic discourse is aimed. That's where the point of intervention is. And what, in a certain sense, the whole project is trying to bring together these two, you know, German Jewish thinkers who are both interested in this, you know, the strange kernel of selfhood, both interested in intervening into it, both thinking you needed a new kind of discourse to address it. It has to be addressed in a new way. For Freud, it's addressed in the psychoanalytic session, a new kind of speech situation, transference, working through of transference. I mean, it's a strange speech situation that also has to be staged in a certain way. You know, you're ultimately intimate, but there's no eye contact. I mean, there's all these, you know, complex and ways of organizing this new kind of address that will be precisely not an interpolating address. Still an address, but not an interpolating address, not an invitation to a new symbolic identity, but an address at that meta-ethical, defiant contraction from symbolic identity that constrains your possibilities in the space of the symbolic. On the other hand, Rosenzweig, who thinks ultimately what the Judeo-Christian tradition is about is elaborating ways of addressing that as well, and that's ultimately what neighbor love is. So you have these two, contemporaneously, these two projects, both thinkers, Rosenzweig very clearly, but Freud more subterraneously, think of their project as Judaic, you know, or being indebted to the Judeo-Christian tradition. And they're both elaborating a new concept of the strange neighbor, the neighbor thing. And are both convinced that you have to think through a new kind of speech situation, a new form of discourse that will open that up to mobility, flexibility, mutation. So I think maybe, you know, I'll just stop there, because, you know, and, you know, we could just talk more informally.
Is not your typical Jew, into backward to Spinoza, forward to Wittgenstein, and laterally to Freud.
Wow.
That's really, because you go to first principles, if you're in, that's basically, he's a male Spinoza.
No, he's not. I mean, he radically critiques Spinoza. And the reason, why does he critique
Spinoza?
No, it's not about rationalism. It's about what's crucial is, in a certain sense, that part of the human that breaks with substance, that breaks with the chain of being, that isn't that in a way that's in excess of nature.
It's almost anonymous.
It's a critique for him. Pantheism. All pantheism is a form of B equals A. The what's particularly being taken up into the all.
the commission then, it's not meta ethics, it's orthoethics, because the two, the ich and the selves, come juxtaposed and become exactly where they should be. So it's an ortho. It's not beyond
its next to. Ortho suggests a kind of discipline, you know, but I...
The two come into Greek harmony.
I'm saying exactly the opposite. It's not about, in a way, Freud and Rosenzweig both begin with a dimension of the self that is out of joint with any harmonious social or natural being or belonging.
When B is A equals A.
Any B equals A.
Okay. What if B equals B? You're really having the moment of grace where things...
No, it's precisely not fitting it. In fact, okay, what... Let me put it this way. It's the moment of grace for Freud, call it the successful cure, and the moment of grace for Rosenzweig, which would be something like becoming answerable upon the call of neighbor love, upon contact with neighbor love, in a way fully becoming answerable in the world, are not modes of being integrated. The cure is not one's better integration into the world, and the response of grace is not being better integrated into the world or sociality. No, I think it's not. I think that's the problem. It's thinking about it in terms of identity. It's let me put it this way. Let me read a passage from Harold Bloom. It's the passage that I think really got me going on this project. And he's arguing here with Freud, with Freud's understanding of authority in the Jewish tradition. And Bloom says that Freud's conception of authority is more Roman than Judaic. And this is the quote: "Yahweh is not an authority, which, after all, is a Roman conception and not a Jewish one. An authority founds and augments, as Freud founded and augmented. But Yahweh is a creator, a revealer, and a redeemer, whose attributes yield us the blessings of more life, rather than those that ensue from the foundation and augmentation of institutions." And this is the crucial difference that I think ultimately Freud knows this, because I think psychoanalysis is interested in the blessings of more life, not the blessings that have to do with the augmentation of, let's say, one's institutional identities, social institutional identities. And I think what you're pushing the argument more toward, you know, what Bloom calls the foundation and augmentation of institutions, that is, socially intelligible being. And the blessings of more life are precisely an intervention into the dilemmas of our habitation of institutional being.
Here,
something.
In Fulton theory, there is the strangeness, which you relate to, which is interesting. Strangeness is not funniness or unusual. It's a particular trajectory between a point becoming a wave and vice versa, which is a singularity, really. And singularity, in human terms, has been addressed in various terms, subjectivity later on, and also the question of identity, which is really between eros and thanatos.
Well, but again, let's call it elan vital, but I think, what I'm saying that we actually need a new concept of animation. That our normal sense, our normal understanding of being animated is not enough, and that's why I was trying to introduce this other term, undeadness. Which is another kind of animation, but it has a mechanical, driven quality, which I think we normally don't associate with elan vital. So in a way, like Freud, let's say Freud and Rosenzweig are not Lebensphilosophen. They're not life philosophers. But there's something that they do that looks like life philosophy. And the crucial thing is to understand the difference. What makes them not life philosophers. And I think, you know, I think you're pushing it more toward that. And I understand the temptation, and clearly they were tempted by this too, Rosenzweig especially, but it was precisely resistance to that, that, and where did they find the resource for the resistance? I think precisely in Judeo-Christian tradition, which is not the typical source for Leibniz philosophy. I'm sorry, yeah? Right.
And sometimes loving your neighbor is, means giving up yourself, and sometimes that's the worst thing you can possibly do. And it seems like that's one of the, I mean, there are many moments, but that's one
right.
of the moments where he really strikes out against the sort of Judeo-Christian ethic.
Yeah, it's true that for Freud, that Freud's relationship to Judaism, his, let's say his insistence on being a Jew, on naming himself a Jew. There's the famous preface he wrote to the Hebrew edition of Totem and Taboo, where he said, I'm sure you know most of you know it, but he says, you know, it's an odd experience to have, you know, to have my book being, you know, translated into, you know, the ancient tongue. Of course, it wasn't the ancient tongue. For you know, a Jew who doesn't practice, doesn't know the ancient tongue, has no relationship to nationalism of any sort, and yet who is, you know, in my deepest being, I think of myself as a Jew. Now, clearly, Freud associated, you know, let's say his Jewishness, not with neighbor love, but with his drive, you know, his, let's say his Wissenschaftstrieb, his, you know, his drive toward abstraction, toward science, toward, you know, toward truth, which he uses this term that's very, you know, rich in German, is he calls it Geistigkeit, Fortschritt in der Geistigkeit, progress in what, in intellectuality, spirituality. Neither one sounds quite, you know, it's quite captures Geistigkeit. So he thinks of Judaism as being this drive toward ever greater Geistigkeit. Now, what I would say is that where neighbor love is, the kind of neighbor love that I'm talking about is manifest, is in psychoanalytic listening. That for Freud, that's, I mean, it's not that he theorizes what he's doing as neighbor love, but I want to say that's where to search for it. That's where Freud is, you know, you could say even thinking about technique, thinking about what psychoanalytic listening is about, what the kind of intervention psychoanalysis is about, that's what I'm saying. That's where we have to look for, even though Freud didn't call it that, the notion of, you know, the Freudian opening toward the neighbor. Right.
When I was Rosado, to be an animalist, you can't be dead, but you need to be a corpse. In other words, the kinds of interventions it's sort of a vulgar psychoanalysis that's the indulgence in being an animal or being invented in a certain way, or an indulgence in a certain kind of interpretation. Whereas the savoir of analysis, that exists for the analyst and him or herself. And, the best that an analyst can do is, pose this this blank face and present the circumstances, but that's all.
Well, I'm not saying exactly what neighbor love,
But that just doesn't seem right. I mean, it's not neighbor love.
Well, what I'm trying to say, what's crucial about it is it's a suspension of a normal kind of intervention, which is advice.
Yeah.
Which is, this is what, your life is messed up, these are the choices, basically a kind of cognitive intervention, which is about, making better choices, all within the symbolic. And what's horrible, let's say, about neighbor love is that it brings to the surface, precisely through this, this what seems like a lack of responsiveness. At least this is how it functions psychoanalytically. I'm not saying this is how it has to look. But it's clearly about bringing the otherness in the other to the fore, about making it palpable for the other who is otherwise dominated by it. So it's about a kind of creating of discomfort. And in a certain sense, you could say that's what neighbor love really is not letting the other avoid the discomfort in their life through the normal ways of discharging discomfort. I mean, that's in a certain sense what you ultimately want someone to do for you, as horrible as it might be. So I want to say still, there's, you know, it's just, I mean, I think that it's proposing a different notion of what this ethical orientation to the neighbor could be, or how to understand it. Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't quite hear the beginning, the first part.
No, I was asking about if the model of neighbor love is not Freudianism, but this terrible notion of behavior as yourself, but rather requires a kind of civility
to all in relation to the neighbor, not in a model of relationship to the neighbor. Yeah, I mean, I think it's, in a certain sense, like the gift that you're giving to the neighbor in neighbor love is the gift of an encounter, a possible encounter with their own restlessness. And it's a very, you know, ambiguous gift. And in a certain sense, it is a gift of shit. You know, you're giving them their, you know, their shit. And, you know, thank you. You know, what a neighbor, you know. But in a certain sense, I think that that's the only way to, I mean, for me to think, you know, about like what Levinas is trying to talk about. I mean, like what is the other, what is the face, you know, of the neighbor? I think it's the face that Freud sees in the rat man, which is this contorted grimace, manifesting, you know, as Freud puts it, a horror at an enjoyment of which he himself is unaware. And the point is to make, at some level, make him aware, make this palpable. Not as meaningful activity, but as precisely a kind of structured, significant stress. A weird kind of congealed animation. You know, it's stuckness, it's rigid, yet it's a kind of intense energy. I mean, that's the paradox. And the gift to the neighbor is, in a way, letting that rise, you know, and become available, so that you could structure a new relationship to it. And so, I mean, clearly for Freud there was a technique of doing this. I'm not saying that there is a, I mean, for Rosenzweig actually there's a technique too, but the technique comes with collective practices. And he has sort of theories about Jewish ritual and Christian practices, the church, music, the role of art. I mean, it's the whole last volume of The Star of Redemption is about, you could say, techniques of neighbor love. And once they become techniques of neighbor love, they are what he calls the work of redemption. And you can think of this actually also in this, you know, in the sort of Lurianic, Kabbalistic sense of gathering the sparks. Now, what are the sparks is, you know, is this weird animation in the other and gathering those sparks, you know, to repair, you know, the tikkun, repairing the world. That's what repair, the work of redemption would be about. So for Freud, you need a technique, but it's, you know, the technique of psychoanalysis, even of the transference. But for Rosenzweig, it also isn't just something you do, you know, like just turning to the other and say, "Hi, I'm there for you." He thinks it ultimately has to be embedded in social practices, and he thinks that Judaism and Christianity have developed kinds of techniques, collective techniques, for, in a way, focusing a new mode of attention, a new ethical orientation around this neighbor thing. Yeah. Right. 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 Right.
Why is the other enjoying differently?
Right.
That is intolerable. So this seems to be one of the problems. Yeah. Because I don't know the words of exactly how I'm making us, the question of this sense of the otherness in Muslim society leaving us, assuming they are more or less equal, and this other in the common that is perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of the perennial question. And also, there are many, and I think probably with good reason, who say that Judaism is Freud. For Freud, Judaism is really, you know, a kind of Lutheran, German Lutheran formation. That's you know, Freud's Judaism. And that Rosenzweig, who actually almost converted to Christianity, and was really, you know, he was ready to do it, and he only decided he wanted to convert to Christianity in the right way, which is by fully being a Jew first, you know, so that his Christianity could sublate his Judaism. He said he wanted to become a Christian like the first Christians. Yes, it was. And he did his dissertation on Hegel. So he said, okay, I'm going to do this right. So he starts, you know, studying, you know, Jewish texts. And then the apocryphal story is he goes 1913 to an Orthodox Yom Kippur service, which is, you know, where you symbolically die. You wear your burial shroud. And he was somehow so, you know, he had an epiphany, and he decides he doesn't have to convert in order to live the kind of life he wants to live. What was I answering? Oh yeah, the Christianity. Now, Rosenzweig, it's very interesting, because Rosenzweig, one can make the argument that Rosenzweig is really, he develops a kind of a Pauline theory of subjectivity. And I'm thinking of like a lot of recent work, you know, by Badiou, by Agamben, and even some older work by Jakob Taubes and by Zizek. You know, I mean, Paul is an obsession now. And I think that one could make a good argument that Rosenzweig is, you know, is very Pauline. In fact, Agamben, at the end of his book on Paul, quotes, argues that Benjamin's theses on the philosophy of history are basically a reading of St. Paul. So, in a way, he reclaims, you know, Benjamin as a Pauline. There are some very interesting questions about sort of the boundaries between, let's say, the Pauline and, you know, between the Sauline and the Pauline. In all of these thinkers, these German Jews, who are steeped in, you could say, Hegelian Christian German culture. So whether there was, you know, their Judaism, you know, may be very, very particular one. But Rosenzweig himself, when he talks in the last part of the Star of Redemption about what he calls these historical shapes, the Gestalten of Judaism and Christianity, he actually says that everything he said about the meta-ethical self really only pertains to Christians on an individual level. For the Jews, in a way, it already happened. They were, their traumatic encounter occurred historically to the people, you know, at Sinai. And so in a certain sense, Jews don't have to undergo conversion. Every Christian, in a way, has to undergo a subjective conversion. Jews don't. They're born Jews. So in a certain sense, what I described as this process, something like a process of, of the intervention of the neighbor love, the becoming available of the meta-ethical kernel, all of that. Rosenzweig says Jews don't need, in a way they don't need to do that. And he even says, for this reason, Jews don't have as vibrant, as robust a spiritual life as Christians. But as a people, they do. It's the people that are, in a way, he doesn't talk about the meta-ethical people, he talks about the meta-historical people. So it's really the Jews as are, in a way, this excess nation, that whereas the Christians are this, each Christian has to experience their excess subjectivity and undergo a conversion on the basis of divine love. So he struggles with this himself. He wants this, a certain model of subjectivity, but then he divides the labor in a certain way, and he says there will always be a difference, and that you need both. You need, in a way, the insistence of the Jews as the nation that doesn't fit in with the nations, but you need Christianity as the universalizing dissemination. But to keep the Christians honest, the Jews have to, in a certain sense, pulsate, in their excess, or else Christianity just becomes basically ideology, empire-like ideology. So I don't know that that's satisfying, but he struggles very much with this, and maybe the place to really think about sort of Lacan is in where he talks about Yahweh in l'envers de la psychanalyse, the ferocious ignorance of Yahweh, all of that stuff, which I don't know very well, but I think that's where. Is that being translated? I've heard that seminar is coming out in English. The 17th seminar? Yeah? Okay, because I called Norton and they didn't seem to know. The person I spoke to in psychology didn't quite know. At Buffalo, I know that Joan Chokchuk, yeah. Yeah, okay. Because I think that will be, will generate more discussion about this. And I think ultimately, and there is a lot more activity on Rosenzweig in the United States and in France. So hopefully that will be a point where, some encounter between those traditions.
Thank you.